This episode of Bun in the Oven is sponsored by Penny and Lola. A family-run children's company born in lockdown exclusively bring you the Happy Song Toys. If you're a parent or a YouTube fan, I can almost guarantee you've heard the incredibly catchy song by Imogen Heap, The Happy Song, this one. The founders of Penny and Lola's new baby was soothed, like so many babies, by the video of the Happy Song, and an idea was sparked to recreate the lovable characters, Cat, Badger and Rabbit, in cuddly toy form, which my daughter absolutely loves. So much so that when we gave them to her, her first words literally were, "I just love them so much, Mummy." The song was designed to make children happy, so these cuddly toys are intended to do exactly the same. Cute and quirky, each toy is soft and fluffy and has squidgy beanie arms and legs, perfect for little hands to hold onto. Each toy is baby safe and CE and UKCA certified. With the purpose of sharing happiness, the founders of Penny and Lola felt it was important to support a cause that is really deserving and chose the NSPCC. So you know with each purchase, the happiness will spread a little further. As a listener, you can use this exclusive offer of 25% off all Penny and Lola toys by using the code BUNINTHEOVEN, all capitals and all one word. There's a dance, dance, dance going on in my heart,
wherever we are. Man meets woman, man marries woman, man has sex with woman, woman gets pregnant. This is the story we so often hear about how children are made, but this is just not the reality for everyone. My name's Holly Grant. I'm the founder of The Bump Plan, and you're listening to Bun in the Oven, a podcast that explores the myriad of challenges and routes to becoming and being a parent. For the last 11 years, I've worked across the globe as a Pilates instructor and advanced pre- and postnatal fitness specialist. During that time, I've worked with thousands of people, have heard hundreds of stories about fertility, infertility, pregnancy, and parenthood, and have learned so much about the often rocky road to becoming a parent, which I find fascinating. Bun in the Oven will dive into the many different ways children are brought into this world and what parenting really involves. I hope you find this podcast a huge source of support and that it helps open all our minds. In this week's episode, we'll be talking about the experience of being pregnant and a parent within a lesbian relationship. My guests are the wonderful Kate Everall and Charlotte Ouellette.
We didn't have fertility issues, and they were asking for us to provide proof of fertility issues. I was like, I don't have fertility issues that I know of. I just can't get pregnant because I'm not having sex with a man, and my partner is not a man. And they said, you know, like Kate said, we needed three rounds of self-funded IUI, or to show that you've been trying to get pregnant for 3 years naturally, which I'm not sure how in the world I'm supposed to show that as a gay woman.
Kate is one half of an award-winning LGBTQ family, travel and lifestyle blog called Lesbomums. Based near Brighton, East Sussex, she writes about life as a two-mum family and everything in between, from raising a son in a two-mum household to their travels and days out. Over the past 8 years, she's also written about LGBTQ history and current affairs, as well as shared her favourite LGBTQ inclusive books for children. I first met Charlotte as a Bump Plan member, and I really enjoyed hearing her journey to pregnancy, and I wanted to know more about the challenges faced when trying to become pregnant in a lesbian relationship. Charlotte and her partner Katie have been together for 5 years, and they started trying to conceive in November 2020. In this episode, Kate and Charlotte highlight the challenges faced when trying to become pregnant in a lesbian relationship, including the financial demands that come through IUI and IVF costs, the support they received from friends and colleagues, and the language used around partners of those who chose to carry the baby. There are some really small considerations that can be made by anyone working in the birthing world when working with same-sex couples that can help both parents feel included, and I loved hearing them. It was such a joy to hear both Kate and Charlotte's experiences, and I hope that one day same-sex couples who wish to grow their family get the support they need much quicker. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hi, both of you, how are you? Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Hello. Morning.
Well, I sound so high-pitched, just super excited. but it's so lovely to both to have you both on the podcast today. I really appreciate you fitting this into your lives, especially because, Kate, you've got a little boy, and Charlotte, you're pregnant right now as well.
I am indeed, yeah. So it's nice to do something at home, and yeah, can just sit and relax and chat, which is good.
Yeah, oh, I've been really, really looking forward to this episode. So I guess let's get straight into it. So I'd love to first of all start with hearing a little bit from both of you as to what your home setup is like. So who do you live with? So Kate, maybe you want to go first.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Kate. I'm one half of a two-mum family. My wife, Sharon, she lives with me also, but I'm the birth mum, so I conceived our son via at-home artificial insemination. So we didn't go via a clinic or anything like that because it just wasn't an accessible option to us at the time. So I'm birth mum to our son T, who's currently six. And we live, where do we live? In Brighton, which is in the south of England, for anyone who is listening overseas.
I love that you had to ask yourself that. Just before we started filming, we did a quick audio test run and I asked Charlotte to let us know what she had for breakfast. And yes. Quite a long pause.
It never ends.
Yeah, also literally just 10 minutes ago. I think it's the baby brain.
None of us are getting enough sleep, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Charlotte, your home life, give us a bit of insight on that.
Yeah, so I live in a teeny weeny little two-bedroom flat in southeast London. With my partner Katie. We've been together for about 5 years. We got engaged. God, I'm so bad with remembering things. About a year ago, I think, we got engaged at Christmas, which was lovely. Started trying for a baby November 2020. And luckily, we're currently pregnant with a little boy and 21 weeks currently. So, just about halfway through.
Oh, that's so exciting. And that kind of leads me on to my next question. So Kate, obviously you already have a little boy, like you've mentioned, and Charlotte, you're currently pregnant. It would be really interesting to kind of go back, first of all, to thinking about, I guess, when you both had the realization that you might be gay and how that maybe then, I wonder, did you then think, well, you know, where did children come into that, and the realization that it might not be necessarily straightforward. So Kate, I don't know if you want to go first on that one.
Yeah, sure. I grew up in quite a sort of open sort of family, so the whole coming out process to my mum wasn't really sort of a traumatic experience, luckily or thankfully. I told my mum when we were washing up together to say that, you know, I'm attracted to women, or I think I might be gay, because back then there wasn't queer wasn't used as the word it is today, so it was very much gay, lesbian, bi. I I think I'm a lesbian, I think I'm gay, and she's like, oh, okay, that's great. I think she knew, just by, because she's gay, she just knew, but she didn't say that because that can be quite it can ruin the moment. So she's like, oh, that's lovely. So the actual experience of coming out initially to friends and family was actually quite a pleasant experience. So when I then met my now wife, Sharon, kids weren't really on the cards. I wasn't particularly maternal. I enjoyed puppies coming into the office more than babies. And I didn't really get it, but I sort of suddenly had the pangs of wanting to become parent, that we then started exploring our options, and it's only then that we realized how inaccessible it is to same-sex or sort of non-mixed couples, especially if you don't really have the finances either. Like, it's tens of thousands of pounds for IVF or IUI, and that wasn't an option for us. And then sort of 7-8 years ago, you didn't have payment plans, you didn't have, you know, loans to have fertility treatment. It was very much try for double the amount of time of a mixed sex couple and then we'll consider sort of helping you out. So it's only then that we realize that perhaps it might be a bit difficult for us, not even taking into consideration that I might have problems along the way. Again, in school you're taught don't even go near a penis because you might fall pregnant, but that actually was quite the opposite thing for us. We tried for 2 years, really, with a lot of quite a few challenges, and we had no support. So yeah, so we didn't really think of kids before when I came out. I just didn't think we'd have kids. I thought we'd go on lots of holidays and have lots of cats, but then it just changed when my body clock or whatever it was that changed inside me.
And was Sharon kind of at the same point as you as well? Did you kind of both hit that point where you said, I think we want children, or was it staggered?
Sharon's definitely more maternal, or certainly was more maternal than I was. So she had, she grew up with lots of cousins when she was a kid. She had a big family, whereas again, I had a very small family. So I don't know if that had an effect on anything. She's always had friends that had kids. I didn't really have friends that had kids. So she's always been around babies. So I think she's probably had the opportunity to have those thoughts of what it would be like to become a mother a lot earlier on than I did. Mm-hmm. So I had a bit of catching up to do. So she's always wanted kids, but she's never had that sense of, we never sort of put our cards on the table to go, well, I definitely want kids. It was one of those things that we flowed. And if it was right for us, then it's right for us. I don't think she would have resented or split up or anything if I didn't want kids. It's one of those sort of all or nothing. It's both of us or not. I want to be with you. Yes, mm-hmm. But if that's not an option, then that's cool. But we were quite fortunate in the fact that we were at the right place at the right time along both the sort of journey that we were both on.
That's really lucky, because you fall in love with who you fall in love with. It's not like you sit down with a checklist of all the things that you want from your life and you're like, does this match up to you? And you fall in love, and then maybe later down the line you might have those types of conversations. And we'll kind of come back to what you said about, you know, how you then had to explore the logistics of getting pregnant as a same-sex couple in just a moment. But it really resonated that, you know, even in a straight couple, you are taught at school, like you said, you know, don't even look at a penis because you get pregnant. And then it's only when you start trying, you realise actually how difficult it can be. And, you know, it didn't take me and Stuart a huge amount of time. It took us a year, which we weren't expecting at all. When you then add in the fact that it's not quite as simple as just having sex every single day and hoping that something comes of it, you know, you can all of a sudden realize that it can take a lot longer than you'd initially expected. So Charlotte, same for you then, same question. When did you guys start thinking about having children, and what was your experience?
Yeah, so in terms of kind of coming out and thinking about children at that stage, I was quite early for me. Well, I don't know if this is early in the grand scheme of things, but probably sort of finishing school, 18 years old, something like that. I just started to think, oh, girls are nice, and never really had much luck with boys. You know, I wasn't. So I actually grew up abroad. So I was living in Japan at the time. And I was, you know, the only black person, the only bigger bodied person. Though at the time, compared to now, not bigger bodied at all. But at the time, you know, I felt that way compared to all my other kind of Japanese friends and, you know, white friends. So I just always was kind of quite other anyway. So never really had much luck with the boys. So then I started to realize, you know, that's not something that I'm really interested in. And actually, I really like girls. And for a while, sort of when I started uni, it was very much like, oh, you know, bisexual and that kind of thing. And then after a while, I was just, yeah, just not interested in men whatsoever. And had my first girlfriend probably around 20 years old, and told my parents at that point. And I remember my mum, I mean, I grew up with lots of gay people around me. So my mum had lots of gay friends, mainly men. But, you know, it was never kind of a big taboo issue at all, really. When I told her, she just said, you know, that's great, but I just hope life isn't more difficult for you. And I remember thinking like, oh, you know, I can't imagine what would possibly be difficult. I mean, I just get to meet loads of girls. Sounds great to me. But then, yeah, so, you know, in terms of the family side of things, it wasn't, you know, too much of a big deal. And I had some really lovely kind of long-term relationships, didn't do too much dating around. But children wasn't really something I'd thought about too much. And I suppose naively, I'd assumed that, you know, once I decided to have children, it would be fine. And I'd go to the NHS and be like, oh, well, me and my partner want to have kids, so help us out. And obviously, when me and Katie started to think about it, we very quickly realized that wasn't the case. But Katie's actually 12 years older than me. So she was kind of wanting to have children sooner than I would have maybe naturally done it if we were kind of the same age, if that makes sense. And she definitely didn't want to carry, was not interested in any of that at all. So she was thinking, you know, adoption would be a really nice route. But at that time I was, I just wanted to carry a baby. I wanted to be pregnant, wanted to have a baby. So I kind of, you know, convinced her that maybe at the beginning we'd try for a baby, and then adoption, we could look at something sort of later down the line. And so I hope maybe that's something we'll do in the future. But yeah, that's kind of the evolution into where we got to in terms of deciding to get pregnant. And naively thinking that we could do it free on the NHS, which didn't quite work out in the end.
So you both kind of mentioned how it was only when you decided that you wanted to have children that you then started to explore your options. Kate, were you surprised? I mean, what are the options if you want to have, if you want to carry a baby in a same-sex couple?
So, I mean, I don't know the sort of up-to-date sort of rules, and then equally each area is different. So when we were trying, we were in a very liberal area. The sort of attitude of my GP was very much, well, because you sort of chosen a non-conventional route to have children, there's nothing really we can really do, and you're going to have to try. I think it was something like we would have to try, I don't know, for six, seven years, whereas a mixed sex couple would try for maybe 3 or 4, which is blatant discrimination. But again, mm-hmm. and then it wasn't really something that was spoken about because people had the attitude of, well, you chose to be gay, so why should we have to bill for that? So when we were looking, like I said, we started with the NHS, realised that wouldn't have been an option, or certainly they said, well, you have to try X amount of rounds of self-funded IVF mm-hmm. before we would help you. And again, that's not accessible to us because we didn't have £10,000 in the kitty, and £10,000 would be for like per cycle. And you know, unless you are incredibly lucky, not many people fall pregnant on the first cycle. So you were potentially looking at like £30,000-£40,000 for a cycle. If that's what it took, if you hadn't had fertility issues, you're then looking at a lot more. The bill would be astronomical. So and we looked at other options. Some people we know went abroad to Denmark, which is a little bit cheaper, egg donation to sort of reduce the bill, and in the end we found a place called Pride Angel, who is sort of like a matchmaking service for people who need sperm donors, egg donors, surrogates, co-parents, the lot really. And we found a donor there. And like, you can't really, you don't have to pay for sperm because paying for sperm is illegal, but we would perhaps pay for their petrol. And it was just obviously a more accessible option to try and find, to fall pregnant really. So that's where we went. But obviously 2 years down the line is a lot to ask of someone to commit to. And they did, luckily. And that sort of went there really, but it was quite a hard time because you felt like you're being punished for something that you can help. You're born gay and you felt like you're being punished when you should be going through quite a magical moment. Like there was, by the end of it, there was nothing romantic about it. There was no, let's quick have an early night. It was very much, right, are you ovulating? Have you got this sign? Have you temperature, legs up in the air? There was absolutely nothing romantic about it. It was very, very, methodical and scientific, and it was just getting the job done. And it was just, it was hard.
And was it an easy decision for you to decide who would carry? Or was it kind of you were both happy to?
Yeah, I mean, I think Sharon was very much you can carry, like, although she's 5 years older, so it wasn't much of a difference. But neither of us sort of experienced any issues with our, organs or anything when it came to that sort of thing. So we weren't, aware of any issues. So we sort of went in quite equally, but she was very much, well, you can do it. And we went through both of our maternity packages at first to see who would have the better deal. And I think she had slightly better deal when it came to maternity leave and payment and things like that. But I think I had a greater need than she perhaps did to carry the baby. So we just went with me. And later on, we thought, well, maybe if we fancy doing it again, Sharon might give it a go. But then she saw what I went through and was like, absolutely not. So I'm very happy much the I'm happy you doing that job. You take one for the team, it's fine. So I'm very much like the oven if we think about having children later, but I'm quite happy where we are at the moment.
Isn't it interesting how we see kind of baby making or starting a family in the movies? It's actually just so different in reality, isn't it? Especially if you are, maybe at the beginning it might be a bit exciting in a straight couple, but as soon as you hit any barriers, it does suddenly become very unromantic, very clinical, very like you said, have you taken your temperature, have you tracked your ovulation? It suddenly becomes, a lot of the passion and excitement goes out of it. And I don't think we're always shown that in media. Maybe we should be a bit more. Charlotte, is that kind of, does that resonate with you, what Kate's saying? Is that a similar situation for you guys?
Yeah, it sounds really similar, especially kind of at the beginning. We contacted like our local CCG, Clinical Commissioning Group, I think that stands for. They're kind of the people that set the different rules for different areas in terms of how they give out various medical support, I suppose. And so we got in touch with them to see what options were available for us in terms of making a family. And I think, you know, the NHS is very much geared towards you have fertility issues, so let's help you, which is, you know, absolutely fine because many people do need that support. But obviously for us, we didn't have fertility issues and they were asking for us to provide proof of fertility issues. It's like, I don't have fertility issues that I know of. I just can't get pregnant because I'm not having sex with a man and my partner is not a man. It's like, I don't, you know, I don't have any medical reason why I may not get pregnant. And they said, you know, like Kate said, we needed three rounds of self-funded IUI or to show that you've been trying to get pregnant for 3 years naturally, which I'm not sure how in the world I'm supposed to show that as a gay woman. Doesn't make any sense. So that was kind of the first barrier. And then for me, other things around really strict BMI rules. So our CCG said you can't have a BMI over 30 to go into fertility treatment. My BMI at the time was about 35. It's a lot more now, but like at the time, you know, I was playing rugby. I've never felt like my weight has been a barrier to anything because I've always been quite sporty and I like playing sports, basically. That's like my passion. So for them to say that I was too big to even try to get pregnant, I just thought was absolutely bizarre. Also considering how many bigger bodied women get pregnant who are straight and, you know, don't have to lose weight to try and have their own child. So yeah, there were a few barriers for us. And I just felt like, you know, I don't want to sit here and try and lose like 5 stone to, you know, to do that. So for us, I didn't actually know about, was it Pride Angels that you said, Kate? Mm-hmm. Yeah, sounds really interesting, actually. You didn't know about anything like that. I knew kind of there's some dodgy Facebook groups that people join and I've watched a documentary on it and, you know, really kind of unsafe ways of that women are forced to get pregnant in same-sex couples, which is, you know, obviously really sad that people have to do that. But we decided to go through the clinic route and we started off with IUI, which was cheaper. So it was maybe like $5,000 a time. Which isn't cheap at all, but and we did 2 rounds which failed, which is quite normal. Like it's kind of just like having timed intercourse, but paying £5,000 to do that. And it didn't work. And after that, I thought, I don't want to keep paying $5,000 a pop for something that's quite low chance of working. So we decided to transition to IVF, which is obviously a lot more expensive, but a lot higher chance of working. And yeah, we luckily got pregnant on the first round and we've got 9 embryos in the freezer, which is good. So if we want another baby or two, hopefully we can have them from that. So yeah, that's kind of where we came to. But I mean, all in all, I think we're probably $20,000 out of pocket, which is just, yeah, madness. And you know, you don't get any help with that. So luckily we had family, we had savings that were able to help us, but it's just a massive barrier. Most people can't afford that. And it's really not fair.
No.
That is, yeah, the thought that you want a child more than anything in the world with the person that you love more than anyone in the world. And yet there's essentially a price on that. And there will be, yeah, so many couples that can't afford that. Oh yeah, that's really interesting to hear just how expensive it is.
This episode of Bun in the Oven is sponsored by The Bump Plan. Given the theme of this podcast, I imagine that some of you are currently pregnant or planning a family. So many women I know just aren't sure how to move their body safely during this changing time. Or they want to stay active but need someone to show them the way and hold their hand. That's where The Bump Plan comes in. The Bump Plan is a holistic prenatal fitness plan that allows you to work out with confidence at each trimester of your pregnancy. Founded by myself, Holly Grant, the Bump Plan has already helped over 10,000 pregnant women stay active safely and feel empowered throughout their pregnancies. Through its trimester-specific workouts, in which I'm always at the same stage of my pregnancy as you will be in yours, hypnobirthing subscription and extensive education hub, you'll feel supported and part of a welcome community. Let me help you move safely through your pregnancy, maintain your fitness and strength, and enter parenthood strong and prepared for all the demands it poses. As a listener of Bun in the Oven, I'm offering you £5 per month off the cost of your monthly subscription to the Bump Plan, simply by entering the code BUN at checkout. To get started today, simply head to pilatespt.co.uk/the-bump-plan and enter the code BUN at checkout. That's B-U-N in lowercase to get £5 off the monthly cost of the bump plan. Join our community today and stay strong throughout your pregnancy.
How have you found kind of the process of IUI and IVF? I don't know if you're if you feel comfortable talking through kind of how it works, because obviously for lots of people who just got pregnant, you know, having sex, got pregnant, never been down an IVF route, it'd be interesting to know what are the logistics? How does it work?
Yeah, so I guess IUI is usually what they recommend to try, like if you don't have any fertility issues. And basically, it's just a case of timing your period. And then when you have the peak ovulation day, you go to the clinic and they put the sperm in, which is like, you know, high sperm count, washed and perfect sperm. And they put it in at the perfect time. And the idea is that it works and the egg, you know, would fertilize. Sometimes with IUI as well, they can use kind of medication as well to stimulate the follicles and to help it have a higher chance of working. So we did one round of unmedicated and one round of medicated IUI. So it's basically just like medicalized timed intercourse, really. That's kind of how I see it. And I think naively, I was like, we're never going to need IVF. IVF is for people that have fertility issues, but obviously it'll work. Like IUI, there's no reason why it wouldn't work. But it didn't kind of the first two times. And then IVF is where they take out your eggs. So you take medication again to stimulate your follicles to try and get as many high quality eggs as possible. And they basically then get harvested. And then those eggs kind of get tested and all the good ones get mixed with the sperm. And then they're left to fertilize for about 5 days. And they turn into what's called a blastocyst, which is kind of like, it's a fertilized egg basically. And then they put that back in again at like the perfect date, and it's all timed. And you take different medications as well to help it stick. And then you can kind of freeze the rest of your embryos that you have left over. And then then 2 weeks later you take a pregnancy test and hope that it's nuzzled in your uterus growing. And that's kind of how IVF works, really.
That's a lot of medication, a lot of waiting, and a lot of pressure, I would imagine, on both of you being the carrier. Did you feel pressure that it, you know, you really needed to work?
I think it's just really hard not knowing. You know, you don't have any control. Obviously, there's things that you can do, like, you know, eating well, not smoking, not drinking caffeine, all the obvious stuff. But you're really kind of out of control and you're just so much waiting. And I feel like, because even now I'm pregnant, I still feel like I'm just in that holding pattern, because before we even got pregnant, it was like 2 months of doing other stuff, you know, waiting for this day and injecting yourself every day in the stomach and all of that kind of stuff. So it's just a lot of waiting, a lot of hoping, you know, that you kind of get over the next hurdle, like, you know, is the pregnancy test going to be positive and is the embryo going to be okay at 6 weeks? And then you get to your 12-week scan and then, you know, you think, when I get to the next stage, I'll feel like, okay, this is fine, but I'm still not there yet. And I realize I won't be there until baby's in my arms, I don't think. It just kind of, I feel like it's just taken away a little bit of the excitement a bit, just because it's just been such a long process and so medicalized. I just can't quite relax into it just yet. But I'm sure lots of parents feel that way, even if it's not IVF.
They definitely do. Again, I think when we see pregnant women in the media, you're supposed to glow and feel fantastic and oh my gosh, this is amazing, I can't wait for the baby to arrive. And actually, for many, many people, that's just not the experience that they have. And actually, it's until their baby is in their arms, it's a lot of nervousness and constantly being fearful of scans and just a feeling of holding their breath until the baby's finally here and you have a bit more control over your life. So I think that's really common. I think the more people that talk about that, the less people will feel alone or nervous to admit the same thing, that, you know, it is quite a nerve-wracking time.
I think people would be, I think people would probably be more sensitive. And dare I say, I'd like to think that if people realised how much pressure it puts on people who want to fall pregnant, people might actually change legislation to sort of try and support us because they'd be more sympathetic to it. Like for me, when we were trying for 2 years, that was 2 years of, you know, jobs that I didn't apply for in case I fell pregnant, because we all know how discriminatory it can be when you then do fall pregnant and want to ask for flexible working and things like that, that you think, okay, well, I won't go for that job because in case I fall pregnant, I'll have to go on maternity leave. And that's a really, you know, shitty thing to do. So I didn't do that. We didn't really travel that far again in case I was pregnant. And so we pretty much put our life on hold. And, you know, it just absolutely, I'm not dare I say ruins your life, but it just you dedicate so much time to it that you're almost not present for anything else. You're just this floating thing going through your cycles, you know, because I said it's 2 weeks, it doesn't sound long, but you think 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, 2 weeks waiting, 2 weeks waiting for your period, you know, it's just all that. And so you think that for however long, it's really painful. And like I said, I don't think people really talk about it that much, because I think if people did talk about it, people would understand and maybe be more sympathetic to it.
Absolutely.
And were you both quite open with family and friends when you were trying, or did you do kind of like the traditional waiting until 12 weeks, which still I just think just is not helpful for anybody?
Yeah, I did the latter, basically, because I was so scared, because we've been doing it for so long. I was in that mindset of don't say anything, because just in case the sort of the baby gods who largely told someone. And it's ridiculous, like you said, it's ridiculous. No words are going to suddenly make you lose that baby. It's just it's something that unfortunately happens, but you telling people you're pregnant from day one isn't going to contribute to that. But yeah, I didn't tell anyone that we were trying, mainly because I didn't want people in my business. I didn't want people to see every going, how did it go? Because that would be just even worse. I already had a wife here, sort of fingers crossed and hoping. So I didn't want anyone else in my business. So we kept quiet until we were pregnant, well, 12 weeks pregnant. And that was it. So yeah, and sometimes my mum was like, oh, I wish you told me so I could have supported you. I said, yeah, but that's it. I didn't want you in my business. So, yeah, each to their own. Some people do like to tell people so that you can get that support around you straight away. But for me, I was very much, I don't know, maybe it's a shame thing. I don't know if you want to unpick it. Maybe it was a shame thing of, I don't want to tell people because if something happens, it's my fault and you have to tell them again. Because I worked in a environment where you wore a uniform, and when you were pregnant, your uniform changed because you then had to indicate that you were on like lighter duties at the time. So I know I've experienced plenty of people who are suddenly in light duties and then suddenly they're not, and they're back in their uniform again, and I didn't want to go through that, so I didn't tell anyone. And that's another reason why. So it's a lot to go through.
That's so much to go through, and so many things to have to think about. And like you said, you don't just get to concentrate on you. It's thinking about everything around you and your job and travel. And it's not just as simple as waiting to get pregnant. Charlotte, how about you?
Yeah, I was quite the opposite, actually. So I kind of shared everything with my family. From the beginning, which was helpful in a way. But also, like Kate said, it did add a lot of pressure because obviously people are always asking. And I felt like I was having to explain the medical process every time. So my mum was like, oh, so when's this? And I was like, no, we have to do this first. She's like, oh, but I thought you did this. And I was like, no, we have to do that. And just a lot of kind of explaining the ins and outs, which got a bit irritating after a while. But I shared everything. And I shared quite a lot of it on social media and on Instagram, which I found quite useful for myself. Because there's a lot of people out there, and it was really nice to talk to other people that were going through the same thing. And, you know, I met a few people through Instagram in that way. So that was really good. And then we actually announced it at 10 weeks. But as soon as I did it, I regretted it instantly and was like suddenly really fearful. And I was like, what have I done? Like, I've jinxed it. You know, something's going to go wrong now. Because we had a really, really, really rough start, actually, with the pregnancy and in and out of hospital. It wasn't very nice. So I think when I got to a point where I felt like maybe this baby is going to stick, I don't know, I kind of wanted to talk about it and share that with people and share it with my family. But yeah, I think also with work, it was quite useful for them to know. So I work in a very female environment. So I work in the charity sector. So like all of my team is women anyway, who have maybe been through similar things or have had children. So I found it quite useful to to kind of talk to them about things. And obviously when I was in and out of clinic and things like that, it helped for them to know why I was off work. But yeah, so we kind of shared everything. But it's really funny when they talk about this 12 weeks. And I was like, 12 weeks, it's just going to be the most amazing time when we get there. I'll feel like the world is perfect. And I got to the 12-week scan and I was like, I feel no reassurance whatsoever. Like, nothing's changed. Everyone told me that 12 weeks is going to be, you know, everything was going to be fine after that. But actually, I mean, it was great. Obviously, the scan was fine. Baby was fine. But I didn't get that kind of eureka moment of like, you know, past the first trimester, everything's great. I still kind of felt the same nervousness as I did before. So I was like, it's a lie. This 12-week thing is, yeah.
Isn't it interesting, yeah, that 12-week mark as well? Because you've both mentioned that almost feeling of jinxing something if you say something too early. And I was talking to Stuart's grandma the other day about it, and she was saying about back then when she had her three kids, there weren't scans. So you basically just one day kind of realised you were pregnant, and then one day you basically just went into labour. And actually, in some ways, on the one hand, you could look back now and think, well, that must have been really daunting because you didn't have reassurance from scans. But then on the other side, it was that she looks at scans now and thinks, God, that must be really scary each time. But also she was saying that I don't know the facts around this. So it's purely speculation. But she felt that she noticed people starting to get to follow this 12-week announcement with scans because it times in line with your first scan. You have your scan, you get proof, I guess, on the screen that everything is happening as it should, and that's when you finally tell people, whereas back then you would just tell people once you realised you were pregnant. And so she was saying she thinks that that's kind of when this 12-week rule came in, but it does also coincide with a reduction in your risk of miscarriage. So I do understand that. But by waiting until 12 weeks, you know, you then, if you do decide to tell people if you have a miscarriage, you have to first tell them that you were pregnant in the first place, and then also that you lost your baby. Or you don't speak to anybody and you suffer in silence because you didn't tell anyone you were pregnant in the first place. So it is interesting how we put so much pressure on this 12 weeks. And like you said, Charlotte, announcing it and then feeling like everything, oh, phew, the panic's over. But it's not really the reality at all.
No,
I do wonder if maybe more of us announced it earlier. Maybe we could try and change things. But I don't know. It's very heavily ingrained in our society not to tell people before 12 weeks.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I suppose, when you talk about the kind of reduced risk of miscarriage, I suppose that's quite a good marker in itself. But really, it doesn't. I don't know, I felt more reassured after the 20-week scan than I did after the 12. And I think also what was quite funny for me is because with IVF you have scans quite early, you have what's called like a viability scan at 6 weeks to see if the embryo is stuck and if it's actually growing, if there's a heartbeat. And because I had some issues at the beginning, I think by the time I got to my 12-week scan, that was my 7th scan that I'd had. And then I was like, wait, the NHS only give you 2 scans. What the hell? Like I was like taken aback because I was so used to, I started to rely on them for reassurance. And my sister, who's a doctor, she was saying, you know, it's almost like the more you know, the more it can actually be a bit scarier, because it's kind of nice to be in ignorant bliss where you don't have scans, you're just like, baby's growing, and then baby comes and everything's fine. But actually the more you know what could potentially go wrong, and the more medical interventions and scans you have, potentially the more reliant you get on that for reassurance that everything's okay. So I'm learning to kind of trust the body a little bit and realize I'm not going to have scans every week anymore.
Sharon was very similar in that sense, because we were tracking my temperature and mucus and all those lovely things, because she knew probably before I did whether it was sticky or not. So because you would take my temperature and suddenly if she started to see that dip, she'd sort of, sometimes she'd tell me and sometimes she didn't. She'd sort of, I preferred sometimes not knowing. I'd rather just know with the sight of, you know, blood in my pants or something. And it was just, she'd see it. And equally when we were successful and she saw the temperature going up and up and up and up and up, she then couldn't say anything because she didn't want to get too excited to put my hopes up, because it was such a horrible thing to go through to suddenly be really hopeful and then have that crumb crashing down. So it's really interesting when you say that, when you sort of when you're sort of watching and everything, that actually sometimes, yeah, it can be quite stressful doing it that way as well.
Yeah.
Not knowing.
Yeah.
And it can become quite obsessive as well, can't it? You know, checking your temperature or putting it in the app and finding out, you know, when am I next ovulating? It becomes like this just constant counting down days, which is not very enjoyable just from a life point of view. So how did you both find, I mean, Charlotte, you're still in the thick of it, but being pregnant in a same-sex couple, so did you find that you had loads of support around you, or did you find that everyone was kind of on board? How was the experience, I guess, Kate, for you being pregnant in a same-sex couple?
I enjoyed pregnancy. I was very fortunate in the fact that I didn't really suffer with sort of any sickness or anything like that. I was quite lucky, you know, my skin was radiant, it was amazing. And for me, I had a very supportive network, obviously with my parents, and obviously Sharon's family, friends. You know, I was very, you know, I don't want to say lucky, but I was, you know, everyone was really supportive. It was only when I sort of stepped out of my little echo chamber that suddenly people were very, they weren't horrible, but they were just very intrusive. They would ask lots of questions. And certainly me, as a more sort of masculine appearing person, wearing, you know, a shirt and then this big bump, but this big bump that is somewhat bigger than a beer belly, it's quite that you can see the eyes sort of following, like, you know, just as they're walking, this what trying to work me out. And equally, sometimes when I'd go to sort of midwife appointments, and again, my midwife was lovely. Even the ones I had when my midwife was on, you know, leave, were also lovely, but it was just the little things, you know, like having to cross out father on forms and having to, you know, put, you know, things like little things like that that I thought would niggle away, sort of reminded me how, you know, much of a minority I was in comparison to what was the norm. So my actual pregnancy was lovely, and it was only towards the end that it got difficult, but only because he was just so big and now my body was just, you know, but yeah, so it was just, it was a bit of six and two for threes, really. It was a lovely, lovely pregnancy. So I'm grateful that I had that, because I think if I was having a horrible pregnancy, I think it would have just made it 10 times worse, the intrusive looks and thoughts and questions, sorry. So yeah, it was quite an experience. I'd do it again, but I going into it, I thought even Brighton people would be a little bit more, not accepting, but a little bit different. But even then, seeing someone like me then pregnant, especially as I didn't see myself in imagery, it was quite an experience.
Yeah. Do you think that's changing? I mean, so T is 6 years old, isn't he?
Yeah.
Do you think things are changing in the right direction?
Slowly. I mean, you've got CBeebies who are doing wonderful things in regards to representation. You know, you've got the two crabs in Hey Dougie that are clearly a gay couple, and my family, they featured a couple of same-sex parents. But again, certainly for me, again, I'm not what society would call as feminine. Although you define it yourself, society doesn't see me as feminine, they see me as masculine. I think we've got a long way to go before we see, you know, women with short hair like me who are pregnant. A lot of time you see pregnant people, like certainly women with like long floaty dresses and, you know, immaculate skin, and they're smiling and they've got all these floaty dresses on and they're very feminine. You don't see sort of pregnant people in shirts and trousers and dungarees, and you know, it's just a bit changing, and the fact that they're changing what their image of family looks like. But I think they've got a long way to go before I think personally I will feel accepted and represented in mainstream sort of media and society.
That's really insightful, and definitely something for myself to be thinking about. You know, I work in a brand that is aimed at pregnant women and postnatal women, and you know, it's such a small thing that we can do to make sure that we are including imagery and being representative. And sometimes it just takes a little nudge, and it's such an easy thing to do that might make a huge difference, especially for people growing up now.
Yeah.
Charlotte, sorry, go ahead, Kate.
No, I was just going to say, like you can make small differences. Like my friend AJ, who does the Queer Birth Club, she does a course on making, certainly in the birthing world, how you can make your branding, your company more inclusive to the trans and non-binary community by just changing your language and imagery. And it means the world, because then people feel included during a time that they're quite vulnerable and isolated, it makes them feel a bit more included. So there's lots of things you can do quite easily. It's just whether people then want to do it. Yeah, that's it really.
Yeah.
Charlotte, how about you? Anything to kind of add to that? How's your experience been?
Yeah, so I think really similar to Kate, actually. I think obviously like our family have been super supportive and really excited. But I suppose it's more kind of the random questions that you get that aren't, you know, we've never had any outright discrimination in that sense, but it's kind of, you know, always get asked about the sperm donor, like it's the most important thing that ever happened to us. Like every single question is like, so how did you decide the sperm and what does the sperm donor look like? And it's like, for us, actually, it was a very quick decision. And, you know, it was a means to an end. We looked at catalogue, found someone that was like, okay, that works. And then that was it. We really didn't put that much thought into it. Some people do, which is absolutely fine. But for us, it was just not that important. And we just wanted to have a baby. So we didn't think about it too much. But it just seems like people are obsessed with finding out the sperm donor, especially men. And my partner, Katie, she's a train driver, so she works in a very male-dominated workplace. And, yeah, she just gets asked that all the time. So that's quite frustrating. And I think also that the other thing that we're starting to find now is the forms issue that Kate said. So, you know, Katie's been applying for paternity leave at work, and, like, she just, the forms just don't work for her. You know, it's either assuming that she's adopting our child, which she isn't, or that she's just living with me, or that she's the father, and like none of the forms make any sense for her. And I think she's finding that really frustrating as the non-biological mother, because she's like, I am the mother, I'm not just your partner, I'm not co-parenting with you, I'm the child's mother, like that's it, I just didn't give birth to her. Like it's not that hard to understand, but I think a lot of the administrative stuff is lagging behind. So yeah, that's quite frustrating. But we've been quite lucky, like with our midwife. He's been great, and he's been really good at making sure that Katie's really involved from the beginning. And I know that's really important, you know, obviously for her. A lot of it's good at me as the carrying mother. So I think, you know, anything that we can do to make sure that she feels just as part of it and just as included is really, really important. So I think, you know, that's something that I think needs to change. And hopefully it will. Yeah, and I think also in a lot of spaces, it's very much kind of the birth mother and then the father, and then the father goes off and it's like, here's what you can do to be a great father or a birth partner who's a man or whatever. And it's, a lot of information is useful for Katie, but the language around it is not representative of who she is. So I think, you know, that's something that she finds quite difficult. And like, we've got an antenatal course, and there's a bit where they split you off. So she's like, oh, well, I'm just going to be sat in a room full of men, obviously, because there aren't, you know, there aren't going to be very, probably not any other gay couples in the course. And, you know, how is that going to be kind of helpful for her or representative of the mother that she is? So, yeah, I think all of that stuff needs to change. Like, we're included, but the language isn't inclusive.
I know Kate is going to have something to say on this one about the whole both of you being mothers, which I wanted to ask you about in a moment. But there's a few things that came up there, Charlotte. So I think the first thing, the reason why people are so obsessed, or men are so obsessed with the sperm donor, is because men love to be, they love it to be all about them. Yeah. Like, but what about the sperm? Because that's the most important thing. So it's just like another way of them trying to make it more important about them. So, but that's a side note. But what was the other thing I was going to, the other thing I was going to touch on is people being interested in, like, how did you choose the sperm and things? And I guess when I decided to do this podcast, this series of podcasts, and not just this episode, you know, it's that I want to do this to open people's eyes to journeys and experiences that aren't there, so that they can then be more open-minded and be more sensitive to how they speak to other people who maybe haven't had just straightforward man meets woman, man has sex with woman has a baby. But I can completely understand as well that there's a very fine line, and I hope I've managed to meet it, but there's a very fine line between wanting to share your experiences and also it feeling like you're literally like in a museum, and, you know, people are like, oh my gosh, this is fascinating. Yeah. So I think it is finding that balance, and I think people are a lot of people are probably just genuinely really interested because it's different to their experience. And but yeah, I get how can people make sure that you don't feel like it's being nosy?
It's interesting, isn't it?
What would you like to say to people who might then be talking to you, and what would be considered insensitive, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, it's tricky because I don't, with all the people that have asked about the sperm donor, I haven't ever found that it's kind of upsetting or insensitive, but more kind of frustrating. But at the same time, you know, it, like you say, it's an education piece, isn't it? And it's useful for people to learn about that. I suppose, you know, we as kind of gay people, like, shouldn't always feel like we have to burden ourselves with educating other people about things. Like, it's not just our jobs to educate people. So people can go out there and find that information, you know, and if they're truly interested in learning about it, they can do that without kind of burdening people with having to always be sharing that knowledge. But I think, yeah, I think it's good to ask questions. Yeah, it's a fine line on how to do it without being insensitive. I think maybe you take the cues from the people you're speaking to as well. Know that when I get asked about it, my answer is always quite short. And, you know, I say, oh, we just chose someone that had some similar characteristics to Katie, and that was it, really. And hopefully most people would be like, okay, cool, that's the end of that. And it's when you kind of probe and probe when someone clearly has given you their full answer, maybe that's when it gets into the next category of being a bit too pushy. But it is hard to gauge that line, so I do appreciate that as well.
That's really helpful, thanks Charlotte. Kate, so what I was going to come back to you with was, you did a really great post that kind of opened my mind as well, about the fact that a question that you and Sharon get asked quite often is, who's the real mum? Which, after having our conversation today, is a really, really insensitive question. Do you feel that it become, after the pregnancy is out the way and your child is here and you are co-parenting, you know, you are both mums, do you feel that it becomes a bit easier for you both to feel like you're equal, that you are both mum? Whereas during pregnancy, obviously, it's whether you're in a straight couple or same-sex couple, the person carrying the baby is always given most of the attention. You know, even my husband found that, like, it's, you know, it's all about the carrier. What's been your experience of people wanting to know who's the mum, who's the real mum?
It is an awful question, and I get the sentiment behind it. What they're trying to say is who gave birth, who carried, who's birth mum. And sort of even before I answer, I would sort of question them, why do you need to know? What difference does this make to your experience of our relationship, our friendship, our current contact? You know, I mean, I break it down and go, why do you need to know? Because I just think, are you asking everyone this question or just the same-sex couples? Why do you possibly need to know? Because what does it matter? Because if you saw a mixed-sex couple who had adopted, I don't think you'd be as intrusive. But because we're a little bit different and you're curious, and that's okay, I love curiosity and, you know, curious questioning, but you need to, before you even think about and ask that question, ask yourself, what value would this add to the conversation, our relationship that we're having, even if it's like an hour's antenatal clinic, even if it's in the, you know, library sing-song time, like, why do you need to know? And if you must really know, because some people say, oh, well, my sister's going through it, and you want to ask the questioning, then there is a way of asking it. And like Charlotte said, there is a bounty of information that you can find online first. And if you haven't found it, then you can perhaps open the question up to say, I read this really interesting article today, blah, 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 blah. May I ask you a question about how you conceived your son? And there is a way of asking, and not just going, so who's the real mum, as you're wiping, you know, the poo off their bum in the middle of an antenatal clinic? Like, no, like, what? Because then that's going to get my back up, and I'm going to be really quite blunt, especially if I'm tired or hormonal. So there is definitely a way of asking it, and I would more than happy, like, although the burden shouldn't sit on us to educate you, I might be the first same-sex couple, you know, lesbian who's had a baby that this person has ever met. And you can imagine the curiosity, and you want to know because you want to come across as an ally, as someone who's supportive, and it's interesting. But like I said, there's a way to word it, and it's usually, have you got, you know, have you got capacity? Can I talk to you? Can I ask you about this? Because I'm really interested, or my sister's going through it, you know, whatever reasoning. And then ask it sensitively. Say, may I ask who is the birth mum? And then I'll go with it. And that's fine. Anything outside of that, if it's just you being nosy because you want to try and work us out before, you know, you feel comfortable, then I'm not here for that. I'm not here to make you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
That's on you. So yeah, so that there's, it's just like, it is finding that balance. And sometimes people do get it wrong, and I do get it, I can sense it when people are really trying and they've just messed up. You know, when they ask, oh, does T see his father, he says, well, he's got a biological father, but it's actually a donor. And I'm still learning around that language, because someone did a really interesting piece of on donor, the language, you know, donor versus father. And so it's just curious questioning. As long as you can justify why you're asking, and it's not just out of plain nosiness, then I'll be happy to talk about it. But I don't know if I answered your question. It's such a big question, because we get it all the time, so it is varied depending on how I am. But as long as you're not insulting or you know, horrible with your questioning, and it comes from a good place, then most people will see that. And if it's not from a good place, or you're just wanting to be nosy, then go online and find someone else that can answer your questions, rather than the person who's there just trying to be a parent and work things out.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think when with us, because we're still at that beginning stage of you know, being pregnant and having the baby, I suppose we haven't thought too much about these kind of potential scenarios that may come up, and I'm sure they will. I'm sure that they will, and it's really interesting to hear your to hear other people's experiences, because we don't actually have any two-mum families around us, any same-sex families. So I think we're probably naively going into it thinking like, oh, you know, of course we'll be accepted, no one will ask us like weird questions. But actually it's interesting to hear the kind of questions people might ask. And with the who's the real mum, it's so funny, because it's like, just ask what you're trying to ask. You know, what are you trying to get at? Because I'm sure, you know, if you want to ask who gave birth, I actually don't find that insulting. I can say, oh, well, I did, you know, and it was very painful, but it's amazing, or whatever. But, you know, just maybe people need to think more about what, like you say, what information are you trying to get out by asking this question, and just ask it, rather than, I mean, I can't believe people have actually asked you who's the real mum. That really shocks me.
It's just the language. I think I love
it's language.
And I don't want to scare you, but like, so we still get it. He's six. Yeah. And he's in years. Oh my God. Year three. No.
Yeah.
Two. He's in year two in primary school, and we still get it. Not so much from his class, but just other people. Sometimes if we go to a birthday party and a friend of a friend asks, I mean, it happens few and far between now, because we're not meeting new people anymore. But if you do meet new people, people will just be curious. But it's just like you said, it's just, I don't know. Yeah, people have asked who the real mum is. And I think as soon as I start correcting them, going, do you mean who's the biological mum? They go, oh, yes, that's not what I mean. Oh, my God, you're both mums. And the shock is quite interesting. But yeah, if it's not that, it's asking about our donor. And again, I think people just want to work us out. They want to then sort of see whether T looks like Sharon or whether he looks like me, and that's neither here or there, because sometimes he does mannerisms that look like Sharon, and so people often think that that Sharon donated her eggs, and you know, I carried, you know, but people sort of try and work us out. And I think it's really fascinating how people must work you out before anything else. It's really, I don't know whether it's like a animalistic sort of survival tactic, but it's really weird where people have to work you out first and understand you before they even accept you or tolerate you. It's really interesting.
I wonder as well if it's also that I think we often quite like to just put things in a box. And we also, you know, there's a lot of kind of stereotypes around mother's roles and father's roles, and so it's almost like people can't quite understand the concept that you might both be doing the same role. It might genuinely be 50-50. And you know, I think there's just still so much stereotype around a mother's role, and the mother, I don't know, if you gave birth, therefore you've got a bigger role, maybe, which is completely wrong. And in our household, we quite literally split childcare 50-50, because Stu and I both work for the business, so everything is split 50-50. And I know you know, to one of my male clients found that very strange. His actual comment was, oh, he's under the thumb, isn't he? And I just remember that really resonated, thinking, how? We both own this child. We both own this business. Why would it not be 50-50? But I don't think that's very common. And I think we're so used to it being like, oh, there's the mum, so she'll deal with that sort of stuff. And there's the dad, he'll deal with that kind of stuff. And it's almost like they want to then be able to work out who behaves like the mum and who behaves like the dad.
Yeah.
But it's not that way. And also, I don't think it should be that way even for straight couples.
We get that a lot. I think you know, Katie definitely like would present in what is traditionally masculine, whatever that means. As Kate said before, depends how you define that, doesn't really mean much, but traditionally that's what people would see her as. So she gets a lot of the people being like, oh, well, you know, leave the wife at home with the kid, come to the pub, like with us blokes. And she gets a lot of people just treating her, though they know she's a woman, it's like, oh, but she's playing the man's role. So right. Like, we'll have that like banter with her. And to be fair, like she enjoys the pub more than I do. And she has more male friends than I do just because of the industry she works in. But at the end of the day, like she's not a man. And I think she gets really frustrated at that because she sometimes, you know, gets treated like that's the role she's going to play in this relationship. And I think she's really struggling to figure out, you know, how do I, you know, obviously like I want to breastfeed and I'm going to be like the primary feeder, for example, and that kind of thing. So how does Katie manage that within herself being the second mother? She sees herself as a mother, but she's playing that kind of partner role, which traditionally is played by men, and the men do this and the women do that. And I think that whole thing is a little bit of a minefield for her. And I think, yeah, society definitely places her in that man's role, even though we're both women. It's just really strange.
Isn't it interesting how, you know, therefore, because they see her as being in the more masculine role out of the two of you, even though you're both women, that would then mean that she also wants to go to the pub. Like, I love the pub more than my husband.
Yeah. You
know? And it's interesting how we just like to pigeonhole. We like it to be like, they're a boy, they like this, they're a girl, they like this.
Yeah.
And I guess that's where there is an education piece to when it comes to being in a same-sex couple where you're both mothers, and people just haven't seen that enough in maybe the mainstream media.
And it's always, I think, the mainstream media, a lot of the time when they portray a same-sex couple, especially in women, it's usually a masculine feminine dynamic. And I think that's, so people still, it's like it's women, but there's a more mannish one and there's a more womanish one, and that's always how we're presented. And obviously, you know, that's just not the case. And, you know, both of us have different ways of doing things. You know, Katie wears loads of perfume, I don't wear perfume, we both like football, I wear dresses, you know what I mean? Like, come on, it's it's just not that binary. It's ridiculous, but that's how society likes to put same-sex couples still in that male female perspective, heteronormative perspective, even though you're both the same gender.
Yeah, if you remove that, I just found with a lot of this, if you actually just remove all these stereotypes and these sort of like binary rules, actually people are free to be whoever they are, and it would be a lot more accepting to society. Like, we've had the same experiences. Like, I think once Sharon, because someone knew us, someone saw Sharon at the park, and it was very much, oh, where's Kate? You know, the typical, you know, how fathers would, oh, is mum taking a holiday? It's very, so the attitude, is Kate at home, or where's Kate? And she's like, what does it matter? And he caught on a really bad day, because she's like, what does it bloody matter, like, where Kate is? Like, I'm quite capable of looking after my son. And obviously when she went on maternity leave, and even the language is paternity, like, she's like, I'm not going on paternity leave, I'm going on my whatever I am. But you know, she had it when she was leaving, I'm ready to go play dad. It's like, oh, I'm not bloody ready, you know, going to play dad, I'm going to play mother. Like, it's just, again it's banter, but it's just so harmful, because it's just reinforcing the stereotype that I'm othered and I'm different, and I'm having to fit into your norm rather than actually the norm being expanded to include me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I know that this is in no way your job, and we've already talked about this, but I kind of feel like, seeing as we're already on this topic and you guys have given so much information, that hopefully anyone listening to this who may have been insensitive, hopefully now will not be. But is there anything else straight allies can do, or I guess might need to consider, or would just make conversations less awkward? Or anything, I guess, that you would want to say to people, stop doing this. Maybe it's an opportunity to put that on the table now.
I think it's just, like I said, it's just to assume less. So stop making assumptions, and by all means, be curious, but just be considerate with your curiosity. So just be considerate of the fact that the people sat in front of you may have had a difficult journey to where they are today. They might have had a difficult, pregnancy. Just think about how many times this question may have been asked already. Don't think that you're the first person to have asked. It's a lot of time we've been asked this dozens of times before you. Even subconsciously, we can see the look. So it's just, like I said, be curious, but be sensitive to that. And if you don't have to, go try and find an alternative source of information. So go find the source of information first. So diversify your Instagram feed and where you get information from. Look at the bigger picture and see what you could do. And then if you really must talk to a same-sex couple or in an LGBT family about their family, be considerate, be respectful, think about your language. Like, even if you want to ask, go away and think about how you may want to ask it. Be considerate. And then maybe next week at the antenatal class, go, I've been thinking about this and I would like to talk to you about it. And be really gentle about it, because we're at a vulnerable time, especially if we're going through night feeds, our tempers fray. So just be considerate, otherwise you might ruin a relationship that could have got off at the goods. It's just be sensitive with it, I think, is the best way you can do it. And if you can't, then just, unfortunately, it's just not something that you can ask, and it's just none of your business. So
and there can be the fear of saying the wrong thing and having all the best intentions. But when there's, like you've mentioned, Instagram, when there are Instagram accounts out there that are amazing, like both of your accounts, that are giving an insight into your lived experience, then, even if that's the first place that you go, educate yourself more, I guess just not saying anything because you don't want to say the wrong thing is not great, because you could miss out on an amazing friendship by purely just being too nervous to say anything. But yeah, there's definitely sources of information out there that would mean that they wouldn't say the wrong thing.
If you're not going to ask everyone the same question, then don't single out a same-sex couple just because we're other, just because we're different. So like I said, it's just, like I said, finding the source of information first, and just build that relationship first. Don't ask me on day one of the antenatal class. Don't ask me there. Just build your relationship up, and take an interest in the person I am, not just my identity.
Absolutely agree. I think I was just going to say the same thing as you, Kay, about assumption. Like, I think if people just didn't assume, that the world would be a much, much better place, because that's the first thing that puts up that barrier when you've assumed something about someone. And actually, you don't know how people have conceived. Like, even asking about who's a birth mother, or we might have adopted, or we might have used a surrogate, or it might have been an embryo adoption. It might not be either of our biological children. And that can be the case for same-sex couples, straight couples, gay men. It's just, don't assume about how families are made, because there are hundreds and hundreds of ways that people make their children, and each of them are equally valid and beautiful and lovely. And, I think if people are happy to share that with you, then that's great. But just don't assume how people make their families, because you could end up, like you say, really insulting someone, or just losing their potential friendship, which is a real shame, because curiosity got the better of you than actually just learning to know somebody first before asking quite a private question. I mean, you wouldn't ask a straight couple like, oh, how did you conceive? What night did you have sex? What position did you do it in? How enjoyable was it?
Or maybe if you do, then you should just stay at home. But also, that's why I'm so grateful to both of you for being on the podcast, because that's the kind of overarching theme of what I want people to get from this podcast. I've worked with pregnant people for 11 years, so I feel like I have pretty much heard most of it, most of the different ways. I'm sure there are lots of other ways out there that people end up having children, you know, that I haven't heard of. But I think the more we talk about the different ways that babies are brought into this world or even parented, then it might just open people's minds a little bit. And it won't be that there's this stereotype of man has sex with a woman and then you have a baby and you're married and it's all lovely and fantastic and roses. So I really appreciate you both coming on here and being so open and sharing that insight so that hopefully less people will say the wrong things.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for giving us a platform, and thank you for giving us a platform to do that, because I think whilst, like I said, it's not our responsibility, I think sometimes visibility is important, and we've got to say it and explain, actually, this isn't working, but this is working, and just trying to get the message out there. And whilst I'm only one lived experience, there are lots of people out there from our community who may disagree with what I'm saying, go, well, actually, I don't mind this. I think the conversations need to be had as soon as possible, really.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great educational tool as well. You know, I think this conversation, I can already think of like loads of people that I would love to share it with, particularly in Katie's workplace with the train drivers. But also, you know, I think it's just really useful for people to hear from different types of families. So yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Don't thank me. You guys have given up the time. But is there anything that you want to say before we sign off? Anything that you you know, burning bits of information, or maybe there's, you know, there's someone out there in a same-sex relationship who's starting to think about having children. I know that earlier on you mentioned Pride Angels, and we'll put lots of information in the show notes, but any last things that you want to say before we sign off, or have we pretty much covered it all?
I think certainly from my perspective, I think to any same-sex couples or LGBT couples who are trying, I think what I would want to empower them with is the knowledge that you don't have to answer anyone's questioning. You can just say, no, I don't want to answer that. Don't feel that you are obligated to answer anything that anyone asks you, even close family, friends, work colleagues. Like, it's none of anyone's business how you conceived, if you conceived at all, what process you want, how you're going to breastfeed your child, chest feed, anything. So yeah, if I could, because sometimes when you're in the early stages, you feel like you sort of take the role of educator to try and sort of wave the flag for our community. But no, you enjoyed that moment. You don't have to answer a damn thing. And you hold on to that. You're not rude. It's not unkind to not answer someone's intrusive or invasive questioning. You hold on to that private moment between you and your partner, or you on your own if you're a single parent. Yeah, I think that's what I would like to say to anyone who's trying for a baby. You don't have to answer a damn question. So, yeah.
That's
perfect.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kate. Charlotte, anything from your end?
Yeah, I just think it's great to be having this conversation. I hope that these conversations keep happening, particularly for me with the NHS issue and the access to being able to get pregnant. I think that's something that we need to keep talking about, and it really does need to change. Like, I'm not an activist, I don't have a petition for anyone to sign or anything like that, but I think, you know, we need to keep talking about it, because it's not fair and it's really prohibitive to a lot of families. So I hope that in the future, you know, my children won't have to pay £16,000 to have a child, or, you know, I just hope that we can continue to talk about this, and hopefully things will change within the healthcare system
in our lifetime.
Yeah, hope so.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so much to both of you. This has been so interesting, and you've both given so much amazing advice, I'm sure will help so many people. So thank you so much. And I hope that everyone's enjoyed listening. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks very much.
Firstly, I want to say a huge thank you to my guests today for being so open and honest about personal topics on such a public platform. That takes real bravery and will help so many others. I genuinely believe that one person's honesty can help free many. If you found today's episode helpful, please do head to the show notes to find links and support our guests feel may be useful. Secondly, this podcast can only help those who know about it. If you enjoyed this podcast, it would mean so much to me if you could rate us with a 5-star rating and leave us a review, or hit follow to be the first to hear when our next episode lands. While podcasts are easy to listen to, they take a lot of effort to create, and your support in sharing Bun in the Oven will help me encourage more guests to join me for future episodes. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, and enjoy the rest of your day.